Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and glad to be with you. Last week, I talked about what's popularly called the Bush-Nazi connection, which generally revolves around the relations between certain Harriman banks, in particular the Union Banking Corporation, directed by Prescott Bush, and Fritz Thyssen, a German coal and steel magnate. Now, last week I was pronouncing his name Thyssen, which I have now learned is something closer to Thyssen, which I will try to say it a little bit better. And that's who I mean when I say Thyssen. I mean the one that whose name looks like it's pronounced Thyssen in English. Okay. We saw that the relationship is not all that easy to define, as it's made out to be by certain parties I talked about last week. I have received more private comments about this show than any other I've done so far, all praising it and or appreciating the subject matter. An item I now have more information on is the Thyssen-Flick United Steelworks. In the Toby Rogers article I was using for last week's program, and on page after page, wherever you check on the internet, it's written that after Thyssen and Flick merged to form this company, the United Steelworks, George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, were brought in to supervise it. Or it is said, George H. Walker hired Prescott Bush to manage United Steelworks. Well, I found the source, or at least one of the sources of this idea, in a book I wouldn't recommend unless you are a skeptical reader. It's titled The Nazi Hydra in America, Suppressed History of a Century, by Glenn Yaden and John Hawkins. Their description of this on page 52 reads, and I quote, "With the merger, George Walker hired his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, to manage the United Steelworks account," unquote. You see, the last word, account, was dropped off that sentence by some copiers of this. Then that form of it was picked up by numerous others who want to believe, and who want you to believe, that the Bushes were actually managing United Steelworks, a German company. I made this clear last week just by using common sense, but I didn't have this book as a backup to what I was saying. However, I repeat, this book is pure communist propaganda, as you can tell from the title, so approach it with caution. Another book I checked is Webster Tarpley's George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography. Now, when I became a 9/11 truth convert in 2004, I saw Tarpley as a truth teller. But since then, my continuing education has brought me to the position, without a doubt in my mind, that he's just another disinfo agent. He was sent out right in the beginning to take control of the 9/11 story. And strange to say, he's not a right-winger supporting those who carried out these attacks, but he's a very left socialist liberal who always attacks the corporate structure. He's actually a former CIA intelligence operative, similar to Wayne Madsen, who is, quote, telling us the truth from an insider perspective, unquote. Yeah, he's an insider, all right, but he's not telling the truth. In his book, I tried to find the date of the sale of United Steel Corporation by Thyssen Flick to the Harriman Company, because he makes a big deal about it, too. He repeats that at the time, the Harriman Investment Banking Company merged with the British firm Brown Brothers in 1931, note that then it became an Anglo-American company. And the Harriman 15 Corporation, which was a large holding company, held a one-third stake in the Consolidated Silesian Steel Corporation, of which Friedrich Flick was the owner with two-thirds. Now, Tarpley then writes a 1935 Harriman 15 Corporation memo from George Walker announced an agreement had been made in Berlin to sell an 8,000 block of their shares in Consolidated Silesian Steel, unquote. That's the quote. But Tarpley doesn't say who was selling to whom, nor have I found that detail anywhere else. I also did not find the date I was looking for. Just when Tessin Flick sold outright the United Steel Corporation, which was the parent company of Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, sold it outright to Harriman Brown Brothers, and it became, at that time, the Silesian American Corporation. Well, Tarpley Spend, now everybody talks about this sale, but nobody has given the date of it. But Tarpley spends a lot of time quoting documents, out of order, I might say, from the 1942 investigation, which I'll go into more later, which were highly colored by war hysteria and thus war propaganda. But as for pinning down the actual dates and other details for what he claims, he doesn't do it. Thus, I found records for the Silesian American Corporation stating that it was established in Delaware in 1926 and was owned by Silesian Holding Company. I found this on the Wikipedia page for Silesian American Corporation. There's not much on there, but the answer to my question was there. So this company was established in Delaware in 1926. That means that's when the Germans sold out to them. None of these Nazis in America conspiracy theorists want you to know that that's when that happened, long before any war threats were going on or Hitler was really on the scene. They want to give you the impression that all this changed hands during the war or right before the war. Further, I found on this page that the Silesian Holding Company was owned by Anaconda Copper Mining with 65% and the remainder originally by W. Averill Harriman and then by Harriman or close affiliates and associates. So Harriman Company was a minority owner and not the owner of Silesian American Corporation, which was a completely American-owned company from 1926 on. Now, I don't know if Averill Harriman owned the Anaconda Copper Mining Company or not, but I think it would have said so if he did because the way this is worded. So now, after clearing all that up, continuing with some more on this complicated topic, we get to some really interesting stuff. And what I want to read now is a passage from Arthur Butz's Hoax of the 20th Century about the rubber crisis of 1942. This gives us an example of the utter hypocrisy and actually hoax that our politicians were engaged in the year 1942 when the trading with the enemy laws were passed. Now, reading from Butz's book, I'm paraphrasing, beginning on page 73. In 1942, the U.S. found itself at war and lacking a necessary raw material, rubber, because of Japan's control of Malaya and the East Indies, which they gained because of Pearl Harbor, which, as we know, was engineered by President Roosevelt himself. The United States solved this problem by turning to the Germans. Standard Oil of New Jersey and I.G. Farben had made a series of agreements beginning in 1927 covering technical cooperation and mutual licensing agreements. Standard was interested in Buna rubber because it could be made more easily with oil. Their cooperation continued with the consent of the German government up to the outbreak of war and even to some extent after the outbreak of war. Now, let's think about this. In 1927, Standard Oil and I.G. Farben began doing some technical cooperation together and some mutual licensing agreements. And that was well before Adolf Hitler took power in Germany, well before any war talk or anything. And it continued up until, would say, 1939 and even to some extent after that. Now, we'll read about this. Butz tells us the American side benefited greatly from these arrangements, while the Germans got practically nothing out of it. That's understandable because it was Farben that was developing this Buna rubber synthetic rubber processes, and Standard Oil was interested because oil was used in the process. Okay, September 1939, there was the declaration of war by England and France, and that threw these arrangements between Farben and Standard into a certain amount of legal confusion. Of course, the United States was neutral up until the end of 1941, but they weren't really practicing neutrality. So, therefore, there was some problems because of war. So, Farben wanted to clarify the confusion. So, a meeting was set up, which took place on September 22nd, that would be 1939, at The Hague, at which certain legal arrangements were made between the two companies. But these proved to be inadequate, and it wasn't until mid-April 1940, when the war heated up with the Battle of Norway and became real, that the Germans realized that the situation was serious. They were really at war, and they decided to terminate the relations between Farben and Standard. So, a Standard official who was involved in these meetings, by the name of Frank A. Howard, he was a high enough official to be involved in these delicate meetings. He wrote a book about it later on, and he said that the Standard representatives were especially interested to find out whether the Germans had come up with any new processes that were more advanced than what Standard Oil already knew about. Because of the new war situation, the Farben people would not tell them anything like that. Howard says that Standard got they got the idea from the final transfers and documents that Farben had not come up with anything new beyond what they already knew, or anything different. They had not changed their processes. And that turned out to be correct, as they found out later. So what this is saying is that Standard Oil of New Jersey had the processes for making Buna rubber, but not the experience of doing so. Now, on page 74, Butts quotes Naughton, a person who wrote about the chapter on synthetic rubber in History of the Rubber Industry, 1952. Now, Naughton wrote this, quote, "All American knowledge about the Buna processes, which made the American war effort possible, came from these relationships with I.G. Farben, and this is accepted fact in the rubber industry. Nevertheless, Standard later came under some rather stupid criticism and even later legal action on account of them," unquote. Back to Butts saying, this unavailability of rubber set off a major political crisis. U.S. government banned the sale of new automobile tires for civilian purposes because, you know, the rubber shortage, and rationed rubber generally. It was realized that if there were to be any American war effort at all, a gigantic synthetic rubber industry would have to be created fast. There was an American company that had a Buna program going since 1940, but they hadn't gotten very far with it. So by 1942, when the war became a serious issue for the United States, and they wanted to be, you know, creating lots of armaments and so on, there was no practical experience with large-scale use of the Farben processes. Now, this is my comment. We're going to take a look at how parliamentary democracy works. So continuing with Butts, the crisis set off internal political conflicts. The big oil interests had a long lead in the production of Buna S, which is Buna synthetic rubber, I guess, but the farm bloc was dominant in Congress. Now, Buna can be made not only from coal and oil, but also from alcohol, an agricultural product. And, in fact, Germany was making them from both processes. They had four plants, including the last one they built at Auschwitz. The first three, they were using three different kind of processes, And that's why Standard was wondering, you know, which one they were finally going to decide was the best one. So now back to Butts here. Foreseeing the birth of a major new industry, the farm interests started arguing in favor of making Buna from alcohol, which was, in fact, the most expensive method. The effect of these internal political battles was to generate massive confusion and retard the progress of the existing U.S. Buna program. The rubber crisis filled the press in 1942 and was, in fact, the major crisis the U.S. faced in connection with the war. There was constant lamenting that Germany was well ahead of the U.S. and that the U.S. lacked the vital experience with the processes that the Germans possessed. Now, Congress, backing the farm bloc, passed the Rubber Supply Act of 1942, which made it conditional that the rubber was to be made from grain alcohol. Roosevelt vetoed this bill in August and appointed a committee to study the problem headed by Bernard Baruch, a Jew who had chaired the War Industries Board in World War I. This committee produced a report in 1 month, recommended the production of 100 million gallons of additional grain alcohol per year, but also an effort to learn the experiences of the Russians in the production of synthetic rubber. The Russians also had a program of creating synthetic rubber, but it was nowhere near as far developed as what the Germans had, so this effort yielded no results, it says. So, therefore, Butz says, we must assume that somebody in America looked into new developments in Germany, and where they must be looking was Auschwitz, the most advanced developments in Gruner rubber at that time. Butz correctly surmises that American intelligence certainly was doing everything to find out anything and everything that was going on there. So you get the picture? The irony that the Americans had to get help from the Germans to carry on their war against the Germans, and also that the American intelligence had to have known what was going on at the Auschwitz labor camps in 1942. And of course, they knew that nothing out of the ordinary was going on except for labor camps, or something more would have been said about it. But you know, they knew all from that, from 42 on, what was going on at Auschwitz. But that's another issue. So now I want to jump to another book titled The History of Foreign Investment in the United States, 1914 to 1945 by Myra Wilkins, about the congressional committees, the political climate, and the Truman Committee, which is brought up as being so revealing of American business collaborating with the Nazis. I'm going to read a passage from page 533, and quote, meanwhile, testimony before several congressional committees fueled an overall climate of mistrust against big business and foreign investors in the United States. The committee hearings offered profuse details on international business practices far beyond the accusations against that had been brought against SKF US. Well, that's a Swedish firm, a Swedish company that was operating, in the United States. And, of course, Sweden was neutral, and it was therefore doing business with Germany, and Germany depended on Sweden for a lot of things, and it was doing business with everybody, and just as a neutral country can do. But, of course, the United States was neutral up until December 41, but it didn't behave like a neutral country. It only helped out the British and, to some degree, the French. So the Truman Committee, the history of foreign investment here. The Truman Committee investigating national defense preparations, which had presented its first annual report to the Senate on January 15, 1942, convened throughout the war years. It called up 1,798 witnesses to more than 400 sessions and presented 50 reports. In a radio address of June 1942, Senator Harry Truman accused Standard Oil of supplying, quote, the Farben Company complete control of patents in the chemical field, including rubber. You see, this is not quite true. Then he told the American public that Standard Oil, in complete cooperation with IG Farben, had refused to license domestic tire makers. Well, we know that it was Roosevelt who passed a it wasn't a law, but a dictate that domestic tire makers could no longer be supplied with rubber. Needless to say, Truman went on, IG Farben's position was dictated by the German government. You know, blah, 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 this kind of politicizing. By the time of this June broadcast, Standard Oil had already agreed in its March 25, 1942 consent decree to license royalty-free all the patents it had acquired from IG Farben. But this did not quell the hostility, nor did it temper the Washington rhetoric. Unquote. Now, let's stop here and take a look at William Farish, who was one of the people who came under legal action, and I talked about him a little bit last week. He was an oil man in Texas who founded Humble Oil and Refining Company. In 1919, he negotiated with Walter Tegel, head of Standard Oil of New Jersey, to give them a slight majority of the company that would be the Humble Company for $17 million. So Farish served as vice president for 5 years, I guess, of the Humble Company, and in 1922 became president of it. Then in 1933, he became chairman of the board of Standard Oil, and in 1937, he became president of Standard. At the beginning of World War II, Farish was a member of the National Petroleum Industry War Council. Now, sometimes you find more information on Wikipedia than any place else. That's, you know, because so many pages are just really bad that are offered to be looked at. So, going to the wiki page for William Stamps Farish, we learned that he had been a principal in a partnership between Standard Oil, General Motors, owned company named Ethyl Gasoline Corporation and the German company IG Farben. So they jointly owned this venture, which was listed as Ethyl GmbH, and it was involved, according to this wiki page, with the creation of the Auschwitz labor camp on June 14, 1940, to produce artificial rubber from coal. And they also built and then operated the tetraethylene plants in Germany. Well, you know, I'm going to make a correction here, because when they say that the company was involved with the creation of the Auschwitz labor camps, that's just, again, you know, putting things in the wrong way. They weren't involved with that. They were involved with the new factory or plant that was being built there. There was no camp yet. Was being built in that location to produce artificial rubber from coal. That's what Standard Oil was involved with. And, of course, it says General Motors was also involved in this gasoline corporation, which makes sense. So once this plant could begin operations, and at this plant, you know, at this Auschwitz IG Farben plant, they never got around to producing any Buna. They hadn't got that far with the building of it and the organizing of it. But they were producing gasoline and chemicals. And once this plant began operations, then the labor was brought in. And the labor was partly paid labor, always, and partly camp inmates, including POWs. So on March 25th, this is again, I was still on the wiki page for Farish. On March 25th, 1942, U.S. Assistant Attorney General Thurman Arnold announced that Farish, along with other officers of Standard Oil and related companies, pled no contest in the criminal court to conspiring with the Nazi government in Germany. As part of a plea bargain, the charges were dropped in exchange for Standard Oil releasing its German patents and payment of fines totaling about $50,000. Well, then it goes on to say that Farish was fined $1,000, while similar fines were levied against Standard Oil, $5,000 each, for the parent company for several subsidiaries. But this did not interfere with the millions of dollars that Farish had profited as a large stockholder, chairman, and president of Standard Oil. Well, that's what I was saying before, that they went through this show trial having Farish and other people, other of these corporate leaders, admitting that they were conspiring with the Nazis or cooperating with the Nazis to make money and so on. But then, you know, they were acquitted. They were not actually charged with these things, and life went on as normal. This was all just a big show. But he was described by Senator Harry Truman, again, as in public, as approaching treason for profiting from the Nazi war machine and withholding patents from the U.S. government. So the politicians got their political capital out of that. The Roosevelt government got its capital, and the millionaire businessmen got to keep all their money. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I have a little bit more I want to tell you about from the book, The History of Foreign Investment in the United States, to give a nice example of the way these politicians behaved and what they're up to. And then I'll do that when we come back, and I will also then turn to two articles written by Gordon Duff on the Holocaust that I promised you I was going to go through. So stick with us, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Today I'm talking to John Gaunt, British media personality and head of the EU referendum campaign. He's demanding that the British people should be allowed to vote on whether they want to remain members of the European Union. John Gaunt, thanks very much for talking to RT. Now, first of all, tell me a bit about the EU referendum campaign.
This is purely about getting our democratic right to have a vote, because three leaders have promised us it. It was a Labour Party manifesto commitment by Tony Blair, then Gordon Brown, of course. And then David Cameron, famously in opposition, gave a cast-iron guarantee that he would have a referendum on the subject. So once I realised it was that, I thought, yeah, hold on, this is wrong. And I do believe we've been denied our democratic right. So that's why I'm involved in the EU referendum campaign.
It would be costly to implement a referendum on being in the EU. I mean, the UK is already a member of the European Union. Isn't it better just to let sleeping dogs lie?
Yes, it would be costly to leave, but it's costly to be in it. It's costing the British taxpayer £48 million a day to be in the EU. We've just given Ireland another £7 billion of our money. Another £450 million in the budget increase. It's going to be even more than that. So it's costly already. And anyway, I'm not saying vote to get out. What I'm saying is, let's have the discussion, you know, on the BBC and on programmes like this, you know, the pros and cons of Europe, so that the British public can decide whether they want to be in the EU. And I must stress, I'm not, and certainly this campaign isn't, anti-European. It is just saying, let's have a vote, let's have our democratic right. And I think democracy, no matter what it costs, it's a price worth paying.
But you say you're not telling people how to vote, but surely the very fact that you want a referendum suggests that you're not happy with the status quo and therefore want out.
Well clearly the reason we want a referendum is because we want the British public to decide. I personally will probably end up voting to come out. But what I want more than that is I want to have the big grown-up debate about it. I want the BBC to fulfil its role, to have both sides of the argument properly discussed, rather than just peddle, as they have done for so many years, the pro-EU line. We need to have an honest, grown-up debate. Who knows? I may change my views. I may begin to think the £48 million a day we give to the EU is good value. I somewhat doubt it, but I'm quite willing to find out. I just believe in democracy. I'm a Democrat. And I believe, you know, I'll ask you a straightforward question. I'll ask anybody watching this programme. Give me three good reasons why we shouldn't have a referendum. Now, people could give me three good reasons why we should stay in the EU, or three good reasons why we should leave, but I don't think people can come up with three good reasons why we shouldn't have a democratic vote on it.
Well, I'll give you one constitutional reason, the Lisbon Treaty. You said that success...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I want to finish up what I was saying in the first segment with a few more quotes from the history of foreign investment in the United States. To give some idea, as I said, about the political environment and the way our politicians were behaving. So this is from the book, beginning in April 1942, the Truman Committee's inquiry into nefarious business practices was joined by Senator Homer T. Bone's Committee on Patents. Populist Senator Robert A. La Follette from Wisconsin set the tone at these hearings. He said the Standard Oil New Jersey and IG Farben relationships were industrial treason, and he urged the Bone Committee to launch a drive which will, quote, put an end to the economic penetration of America from Nazi firms. Now, this is me now saying my comment, can't you just hear the Star Spangled Banner playing in the background? America is a city on the hill, and Nazi firms who have the technology America wants and needs are evil for that very reason, if for no other. La Follette was a progressive and a member of the Progressive Party. He was also a member of the Republican Party when the Progressive Party wasn't operating. And he was what you'd call a liberal Republican. They had, at that time, they had liberal and conservative Republicans and liberal and conservative Democrats back in those days. Now, La Follette, lambasted, I'm back to the book again, La Follette lambasted the March 1942 consent decree as insufficiently punitive to Standard Oil and anybody else that they were prosecuting there. And Senator Joseph C. O'Mahony of Wyoming declared that Standard Oil New Jersey regard this war as an annoying interruption to their fascist economic alliances, unquote. Well, here's me again. You know what? There's a lot of truth in that, that they regarded it as an annoying interruption. But see, not in the way that he means, because Standard Oil was never for the war. And it's my belief that oil companies are not the warmongers. It's the bankers and the armament makers who are the warmongers. War actually interrupts the profitable work of most major oil companies. They would rather have peace. But are economic alliances fascist? Well, according to these people, they are. If they're not, but if you're a country that you have, if it's with a country you've decided to go to war with, they're fascist, but before that, they're not fascist. So, now back to the book. Senator Bone, upon being informed about the consent decree signed by Standard Oil New Jersey and Dow Chemical, because Dow Chemical was involved in this too. We remember I.G. Farben also produced chemicals. It was a chemical plant. Agreed that they were entirely inadequate. These decrees were entirely inadequate. Senator Bone said, quote, "The sinner has not repented," unquote. And La Follette echoed the committee chairman's sentiments, quote, "He," speaking of Standard Oil and Dow, calling it he claimed patriotism and yielded. To which Bone added, "He got religion only temporarily. He will return to sin after the crisis passes." You know, I have come to really disdain politicians. I used to believe in them. I did. I'm not going to go into that now, but I really disdain them. I think I prefer the corporate leaders, because at least they're producing something more than these people are doing. So this is all for my update about last week's show. And I'm going to turn now to the articles written by Gordon Duff, in which he seems to jump in and out of Holocaust revisionism. I was kind of excited about reading them when they first appeared, but on a careful reading, I thought, what is this really all about? And that's why I wanted to talk to him. But here I am, but I'm still going to talk about them, and I will say that they're definitely revisionist, but just in what way and who is benefiting from them is open to some question. Now, the first one was written over a month ago on November 2nd. It's based on the David Irving YouTube videos of Irving's speaking tour of the United States, in which he was promoting his book, Churchill's War. To start out, this article by Duff is entitled, "Who Put the Hit on Julius Caesar?" And then it says, under that, "History Never Happened, Who Is David Irving?" And Irving writes, "A few days ago, someone sent me a link to a video by David Irving, the British author who professionally debunks everything." Well, see, this is new to Gordon Duff. I saw these videos some years ago, and I was highly impressed by them. They are very impressive. Irving at his best. Duff says, "Irving takes on a lot of targets, but his best debunking is Winston Churchill." I certainly agree with him there, too. I think Churchill's War is Irving's best book. Not that I've read all his books, but I think what he says in there is the most groundbreaking of anything he's written. Now, just to pick out some of the things that are important that Duff is saying about the Holocaust and related issues. He says, "Irving paints Churchill as a villain as great as Hitler, nearly as great as Stalin." He says, "Was World War II started by Churchill, a brilliant but immoral drunk, art forger and scoundrel who took payoffs from foreign intelligence services, banking cabals, and anyone else willing to shove an envelope in his pocket?" Well, this is great stuff. And I would say, yes, it was started by Churchill. But then Duff says, "Everything we know of World War II, of Hitler, of events of the 20th century, is not just a little bit wrong, but outrageously false. What he says, what he writes about Churchill is true. And there again, great statement, because I agree with it. It is. And he also says, Goebbels' wartime attacks on Churchill were far more fact and far less propaganda than our history teaches, if this is true. And this, he says, this is a nasty thought. What if Goebbels was simply telling the truth? Well, I would say, yeah, Goebbels was pretty much telling the truth. Goebbels was not the great psychological genius, you know, or propaganda genius that he's made out to be. He was very good at what he did. He was a very intelligent man. But he was basically, for the most part, telling the truth with probably some spin and trying to make it bring out things that were most beneficial to Germany. But still, it was the Allies who were doing the brilliant psychological job on their enemies, not the other way around. We know so much of what happened, he writes here. I am reading the battle diaries from D-Day. I know there were landings. I know men died, but we don't know why, only what we were told. And I say to this, I would like to say to him that Ike made use of the concentration camp at Ohrdruf near Buchenwald to declare that this is what the soldiers were fighting for, because they really didn't, it was difficult for the Allies to say why they were fighting Germany the way they were and allied with Stalin and the Soviet Union. And when they arrived at some of these camps and found these bodies piled up that had been piled up because they were no longer able to cremate these inmates that were dying from typhus, they made every bit of use of this, and they brought in all the press. And Eisenhower, when he found out about this, made an order to bring all the soldiers that were all anywhere around that area, American soldiers, over there, and they had these, they had them passing through there, and they had a big show going on, showing them just what the Germans had been up to and how they had been murdering all these people. And he said, I'm going to show them just what they're, what they were fighting for. And this is where the idea comes that probably began, that the United States was, and the Allies were fighting this war against Germany to protect and save the Jews, because they were exterminating the Jews, and it was about that, about the concentration camps. And of course, it wasn't. It never was. He also says, everything we believe about World War II is based on one known fact, that Germans are brutal and insane, a race of criminals, vicious monsters with an inbred need to destroy. Well, this is true. Again, he's making some good statements here. But the fact is that he also goes along with ideas that he's making that big separation between the German people and the Nazis, which is what they all want to do. Not all of them, but a lot of them today. That's the idea, except that the Nazis weren't all that much different from the German people, and the Nazis were not brutal and insane, and they weren't criminal monsters either. Actually, now, in this article, he says a lot of good things, but he still wants to blame Hitler. He still wants to see Hitler as basically guilty of those things that he supposedly is guilty of. But he's questioning things. It's very good. But then he writes another article, which is on November 13th. He follows this up with Who Speaks Up for Holocaust Survivors? And this one is more interesting to me now in retrospect, because there's a lot more that I have to say about it. This article was inspired by the stories that had come out, the commissions that were collecting reparations for Holocaust survivors had collected a bunch of money, millions and millions of dollars, for survivors that were not survivors. They were all fakes. And so he is writing, as many as 90% of those claiming to be Holocaust survivors may be frauds. Well, he's very upset about this, but some of the reasons he gives are kind of questionable. He says the state of Israel claims to have alive today nearly 1 million Holocaust survivors. That's an interesting statement. As many as 90% of these may well be not only frauds, but many could easily be former concentration camp guards themselves, far more likely than surviving death camps. So he doesn't believe in these numbers, but he says that in the he believes in death camps, and he says about death camps, there were few survivors, and most of them died immediately after the war. But he says those alive were found dying and couldn't be saved. Well, it's not true that there are a few survivors. There are quite a lot of survivors, and most of them didn't die immediately after the war. And those alive were found dying. Some of them were found in a state of dying from the diseases they had and starvation at the time of the end of the war, and they couldn't be saved. That's true. But here's where he says, there are only 5.3 million Jews listed as living in Europe outside the USSR in 1940. Possible. Then he says, though, in a rough average, 12 death camps filled to the brim with gas chambers and crematoriums ran 24 hours a day for 1,000 days. Well, there weren't 12 death camps. There are supposedly, according to Holocaust historiography, 6 death camps. And they didn't have gas chambers, but who said, you'd believe they do. They weren't running 24 hours a day. They weren't even running every day. Sometimes during heavy, like things like typhus epidemics, they were running heavily, and other times very light. And then he says for 1,000 days, that's about 3 years. But actually, these camps were functioning from 1942, summer or fall, to 1944. And that makes it 2 years, not 3 years. So he's got a lot of error in here. Then he says, some are said in testimony of literally thousands to have killed from 17,000 to 20,000 per day. Let's make the figure 10,000. 10,000 per day times 12 camps times 1,000 days. Well, first, again, in testimony of literally thousands, I do not believe that we have the testimony of thousands of survivors or former inmates that make up the Holocaust story. There's a testimony of far, far fewer than that. There's not really that many whose testimony we have. We rely on the testimony of many, many less than this to convince us that the whole thing is true. And he says, there are concentration camp survivors living in America, people who suffered incomprehensibly at the hands of the Nazis. This is another problem I have. This idea that everybody suffered incomprehensibly who was in that area at that time, particularly if you're Jewish. But being in a concentration camp, for most people, truthfully, they were not suffering incomprehensibly. Some of them, it was inconvenient, and it was not pleasant, and sometimes things were tough, and there were a lot of terrible things going on. Later on, at the end, that's true, but to say that all camp survivors suffered incomprehensibly is just not right. I don't agree with that at all. Then he says, tens of thousands or more who claim falsely to be of the heroic numbers from that period, blah, blah. Well, again, that term, heroic numbers. Everybody who can claim that they can claim themselves as a Holocaust survivor is a heroic human being. And you know, the thing is that we have to question, and I am going to question, just what is a Holocaust survivor? And even what is the Holocaust? They should be calling themselves camp survivors. There should be such a thing as a concentration camp survivor. And that's it. Holocaust survivor is a general term, and that's part of the reason we have this problem with all this fraud and all these people collecting money who don't deserve it. Because all they have to say is that they lived there and they had to hide out or something, you know, they claim, and baloney. Now, but here I want to finish this. He says, I won't even remotely begin comparing service in Vietnam with the experience of a death camp. He's talking about Vietnam veterans and the problems that they have. But when he says, I won't even remotely begin comparing service in Vietnam with the experience of a death camp, he's wrong. Service in Vietnam could be worse than the experience of many of those people in those camps in Poland. The camps in Poland are called death camps, but they weren't necessarily, they weren't death camps. And certainly, I can imagine service experiences that Vietnam vets had to be far worse than anything these people in camps suffered. But it depends on who you are in both cases and what you experienced. You can't make that generalization, though, for sure. He's pushing this idea that all these survivors are really exceptional people who deserve a whole lot. And he says, why then, in the name of all that's holy, did the authorities and news media immediately write this off as tens of thousands of cases of minor lapses in judgment rather than one of the most horrible moral crimes of all time? Now he's saying that if you are lying about being a Holocaust survivor, that is one of the most horrible moral crimes of all time. Now, I don't like the people who do this, but I wouldn't call it that. And why does he call it that? Because he follows that by saying, there is no greater disrespect for a Holocaust victim than this. See, again, the victims are so holy that you cannot, if you show disrespect for the true Holocaust victim, it's the most horrible moral crime of all time. This is some strange language. Now he has a little section here called Revisionists and Deniers, and he says, 2,000 people in Europe are in prison today for questioning some part, no matter how minor, of the Holocaust. Well, he's against that. But he does say that some facilities were reconstructed based on testimony for historical perspective, but in general, it is believed that the Germans destroyed all evidence of death camps and mass graves when they learned they were losing the war. He appears to believe this. He appears to accept that the reason we have no evidence for this Holocaust is because the Germans destroyed it. At least it seems that way. We might be able to give him the benefit of the doubt. But he also says that all these revisionists and deniers, he says some are noted historians, some are scientists, some are activists, and some are simple troublemakers. Now, I wonder which are the troublemakers. I suppose I would fall in that category. Since I'm not a noted historian, I'm not a scientist. And I don't know what an activist means exactly. I'm probably partly an activist, but I'm certainly fall in the category of a troublemaker. At the trials, he says, Holocaust victims claim that such questioning harmed them irreparably. Well, he's right to question that, to say that this is not fair for them to claim such things. And he says some pretty good things in here, but then he says, combat veterans have great difficulty surviving coming home, and so it's easy to extrapolate the same for Holocaust survivors. He says there's no greater potential cause of post-traumatic stress disorder in the history of mankind than the concentration camps of World War II. Well, I would dispute that, absolutely. I think that's completely untrue. There are a lot worse things that can happen to you than being in one of those concentration camps. But we have just been so brainwashed to believe, and people say it all the time. Well, tell me about Elie Wiesel. They'll say, oh, you know, how can you question this man after all the horrible, incomprehensible suffering he went through? What are you talking about, incomprehensible? This kind of exaggeration is ridiculous. So anyway, he ends up saying that only a few hundred Holocaust survivors could be alive today, not a million, but there's some more things that are even more important to me here, and that is, never again. What does it really mean? Now here he says, if one child was taken away, died in a gas chamber, or of typhus, shot, it doesn't matter how they died, one life, this is a Holocaust. Oh, you know, now, no it isn't. No it isn't. How do you justify that? If one child dies of typhus who was, you know, who was maybe put into a camp, or one child was shot, or one life was taken that shouldn't have been taken, this is a Holocaust. Come on, let's use the language properly. Children are being harmed every day all over the world in huge numbers, and nobody calls it a Holocaust. And so let's not talk this way. He says, if it was done because of race, the crime is doubly evil in nature. Once again, no it isn't. What does it matter why it's done? It's just that it's done. under the end of this, under the real war, he says, he makes a statement, all of us, Jews, Germans, the West, all of us, were silent when Joseph Stalin killed twice that number or more. It started before the war and continued after. The human suffering caused by Stalin was immeasurable, but it is never spoken of, barely touched on, except by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and now his books are banned because they fail to conform to popular mythology. Well, that's very good, Gordon. You know, that's very noble, and it's very true, because... But why do you constantly bring up Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in your columns, in your, well, your blogs and your writings, as a kind of a theme, that undercurrent that shows up fairly often, but I never see you mention Joseph Stalin. So I guess you are guilty of that. You're guilty about being silent about Joseph Stalin and focusing on the evil of the Nazis. And this, because you have this fear, or you're pretending like you do, that the Nazis are this fascist threat that we're under now, but the communism is not, that we're not under a threat of that. Then finally you say nobody ever cared about the Holocaust survivors, only what their suffering would bring in honor and riches. Has anyone asked the hard questions, the real questions? Well, I like that you said that, but are you asking the hard, you're starting to ask the questions, but you're doing so in kind of an odd way. However, I understand that people come up to things, you know, a little bit at a time. So I was hoping that we could just discuss some of this when you came on the program. But, so I don't mean to be, giving a hard time here. I only mean to be bringing out that some of this is contradictory. Some of the things you say are a little bit contradictory. You do end this by saying, but never again, what? That's a good question. What you mean is, when you say never again, what never again? What are we talking about? And that's my main point here. What is this Holocaust really all about? When they say never again, what does it really mean? And who is really responsible for what they're talking about, never again? That's all I have time for, listeners. I'm going to be continuing to monitor the Veterans Today site and see what Gordon is writing about and see what we can learn about him. I have real questions about the man, but I'm open. I could be, you know, he could turn out to be a real hero coming along. Who knows? But this is the end of the Gordon Duff story for now, and I thank you all for listening. Tune in next week for something different. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.